In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. I'm sure that on Christmas Day, many of you will have plonked down on your sofas after your Christmas dinner to enjoy the first episode of Netflix's lavish new period drama, Bridgerton. In today's episode, you'll be hearing from the historian Hannah Gregg, who acted as a historical advisor for this new Regency romance, which offers a thoroughly modern and escapist look at the courtship and society of the early 19th century. Putting the questions to Hannah was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Bridgerton has arrived on Netflix. It's a sumptuous drama that reimagines a series of novels by Julia Quinn. And this first series is set in England during the Regency period. And today we'll be chatting to Dr. Hannah Gregg about the historical detail in the drama and the style of the series. But if you're still watching it at the moment or you haven't started yet, don't worry, there won't be any spoilers. Thanks so much for joining us today, Hannah. And perhaps we could start by your giving our listeners a bit of an introduction to the series and your role on it.
Oh, where to begin? Well, I think Bridgerton is like a kind of period drama like no other. It's a new style, really, of kind of period production that we're going to see or have seen on screen. So it's set in Regency London, and it's in the genre of the Regency romance novel. So it's an adaptation of a series of novels by Julia Quinn, who's a modern Regency romance author. But of course, the idea of the Regency romance has quite a long history, in that the Regency has often been a setting for kind of exciting romantic fictions, which is what Bridgerton is. So I am a historian of 18th and early 19th century Britain, and often work as an advisor to film and television. And it was my great fortune to have the opportunity to work with Bridgerton as their etiquette advisor, I think is what the title I was actually given, but basically just the person who got to hang around, having a lovely time talking about history here and there, and just had a chance to see the whole thing come together. So I was, I was very lucky.
Well, that sounds like such a fun role. And perhaps you can talk a bit more about a bit of the advice you were giving on set as we go through the different historical details. But Perhaps we can start by talking about the scandal sheet or the scandal paper, Lady Whistledown. This is a paper that drives some of the action in the show. It reports on some of the action in the show. And I wanted to start by asking, really, scandal sheets like this, did they exist in Regency London? And when did they first come about? How did they affect things in society and the tone?
Yeah, they did. I mean, it's one of the things that I loved from the very first moment I saw the scripts and read the books was this idea of this kind of scandal sheet, you know, underpinning everything where everyone's watching everyone else and all of their secrets are going to be revealed in this pamphlet. And it is actually very much in keeping with how this kind of world of high society was publicised and talked about in the early 19th century. So, I mean, newspapers ran columns about, you know, what the fashionable world was up to. Magazines ran series. The Town and Country magazine ran a series for many decades, actually, that kind of exposed the romances and adultery and scandals within high society. And it was very much the kind of, you know, part and parcel of the print culture of early 19th century London, with the, you know, world of the rich and famous being kind of laid out in the press. I suppose one of the diversions that we have in Bridgerton, which makes it slightly, you know, a move away from history, is that the Lady Whistledown scandal sheets actually name people very clearly with their real name, which is important for us because it helps us keep up with what's going on. But in Regency society, their identities might have been very loosely disguised. So someone might have just printed their initials, like the Duke of H instead of Duke of Hastings or whatever, or some kind of, you know, masked character, but it's so obvious who they were talking about. So it was only a way to kind of get around kind of libel law, basically, because there's no point in having these columns unless everyone knew who you were talking about. But they would have tried to disguise their identity a little bit at the time, whereas in Lady Whistledown scandal sheets, it's named and shamed, named, fully named all the time. So.
And again, no spoilers, but in the drama, this scandal paper does have some very real consequences for the families involved that are being written about. And was that the case in reality as well? Did Regency families suffer this kind of fallout from gossip? It seems like whole families could fall from grace with one of these things.
Yeah, certainly the stakes were really high. And I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at the kind of the real history of this world, this fashionable society. And, you know, it's probably not quite as thrilling as Bridgerton sometimes is, but there's certainly the opportunity for a scandal to break a family. And there's a sort of mismatch between what people were allowed to get to up to in private and then the moment in which a scandal was revealed in public. And if something hit the press, then quite often it would lead to a woman having to remove herself from society, to take a period in exile. And that was even the case for married women as well as unmarried women. So the point in which something becomes newsworthy, if it's going to affect your reputation in some way, then it can be hugely, hugely problematic. So yes, the press has a big power in terms of people's reputation management in Regency society. That is true of the time, and it's what we see happening in Bridgerton as well.
Yeah, you mentioned this dual standard of public and private behaviour there, but there was also this clear dual standard that I don't imagine many viewers will be surprised to see in Bridgerton, that it was a very different world for both men and women, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, you know, particularly when it comes to kind of sex and marriage and courtship. And I mean, historians have often spoken about the kind of double sexual standard that operated in the 18th and early 19th century, where men are permitted a huge amount of sexual freedom, they're encouraged to be voracious and libertine, and particularly amongst aristocratic men. Whereas, you know, elite women, women who have wealth and status, their chastity is quite highly prized and protected until marriage. So there is a very obvious discrepancy between how the expectations of male and female behaviour in early 19th century London.
Bridgerton picks up on the fact that many women then, as a consequence of this level of society, were going into marriage perhaps unprepared for the realities of married life and everything that brings. Is there any evidence of any sex education or kind of etiquette guides that prepared women in this way, or was it all down to the mothers?
Oh, it's a difficult question, isn't it? There's no national curriculum for sex advice. It's so difficult, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, we have this sense in which, you know, the kind of aristocratic women are very carefully policed and managed until marriage, and that, you know, their reputation has to be carefully protected. And yet at the same time, they're living in a society that is really kind of bawdier than we might think, with a lot of very explicit kind of sexual imagery and references. You know, it's the age of the caricature. There's a lot of naked bottoms in Gilray caricatures. There's a lot of kind of sexual innuendo and suggestion in those sorts of images. There's lots of novels available that, you know, are very popular, kind of best-selling novels that have narratives of seduction and risk inherent in them, which women are presumed to be reading and thinking about. So it's sort of hard to know, isn't it? What, you know, how much do they know in advance? I've never come across a letter that said, oh my goodness, I had no idea what was going to happen. And, you know, or I've never come across that precise bit of evidence that's going to tell us that answer clearly. And so it's the historian's answer, isn't it, that it's complicated. That on the one hand, we know that women's access to men is very carefully managed, you know, restricted to the dance floor, people are chaperoned, you know, the greatest risk is that a woman's going to run off with a footman and you don't want that to happen. So they're, you know, they're kind of quite carefully policed. But at the same time, we know that it's a very highly sexualized society where sex is very visible culturally, and I don't know how will we know what that meant to women. I don't know, maybe we'll find out, maybe we'll find the perfect source eventually. But
in Bridgerton, the mothers loom large. They are, yes, fantastic characters. And the marriage market is just portrayed as so brutal for a lot of these young people. What were the mothers' roles in securing matches for their children?
Yeah, the Bridgerton world is the world of the matriarch. And that is in keeping with the kind of historical world that I would recognise, in that there were some very powerful hostesses, as we'd call them, historically, who ran all the balls, who ran the social season, who were kind of managing the marriage market, introducing eligible young people to other eligible young people and kind of managing that pool of flirtation. And I mean, some of the mothers, again, you know, historically were notorious for being really ruthless and trying to get their children well married. And so it was the Duchess of Gordon, I think it was. I think she had four daughters. And, you know, she was always in caricatures, kind of basically pushing her daughters into the lap of some eligible young duke or whatever. And, you know, she was just, no, yeah, famed for her kind of determination to get her daughters well married. And she succeeded. And she got one of them engaged to the Duke of Bedford, who was a very good match. But then sadly, they were engaged and then he died tragically just before the marriage. But she was not put off, was the mother, Duchess of Gordon. She just arranged the engagement between the heir, his brother, and the daughter instead. So her daughter still became the Duchess of Bedford, but just married a different brother to the one that had initially been lined up for her. So yeah, there are these stories of these mothers being absolutely determined and doing everything they can to make sure that their children are well married and managing that. And yeah, we do see that in Bridgerton, these fabulous female characters. Yeah.
So you mentioned the dance floor, the kind of the dance in itself of social interactions. Can you take us inside, either a scene in Bridgerton or just a Regency scene, a dance, and the etiquette that you were kind of advising on and thinking about?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, when I think back to Bridgerton, I just remember the complete joy of seeing some of those dance scenes come together. I mean, they had this amazing choreographer and just the spectacle was just, you know, kind of fabulous to see it when it was being filmed. To be like the historian, I put my historian's hat on. I mean, I think what Bridgerton does well is it shows how highly charged the dance floor is. And we do get a sense of that with period dramas we've seen before, with the kind of Austin, you know, kind of assembly room scenes and things like that. But actually, I think Bridgerton really helps communicate that much more clearly for a modern audience in terms of just how flirtatious and kind of sexy it could be, because dancing was the kind of bodily contact that men and women had before marriage. And it wasn't just like a quick 2-minute disco, you know, like you'd have now. It was an extended period on the dance floor. You know, three dancers or dancing twice with someone was a sign of great interest. And that might mean you're on the dance floor for half an hour in very close, intimate body contact and conversation. So it's incredibly flirtatious, mm-hmm. but also very public. You know, so everyone watching noticed if you had two dancers back to back. And actually some of the earliest uses of the word flirting that I've seen as a historian has come in letters about dancing, like he flirted with me or they were flirting, or, and it seems to be particularly kind of linked to the idea of the dance floor. So I've always been very taken with that idea.
Great. So if that's one way of the way in which the show portrays the social interactions of the time for a modern audience. But another way I certainly loved seeing on screen was the interpretation of the fashions and the music, which has really been updated. What can you say about that and how that goes across to a 21st century audience?
Oh, again, I mean, they had the most amazing, you know, people doing all of that. And it was a real treat because it's one of the only productions I've worked on where everything has been made from scratch. So not just the, you know, the clothes that you see on the lead characters, but everyone in terms of the background artists. And so it's this highly fashionable, brand new kind of world of fashionable display, which I absolutely loved because, of course, you know, this world of the beau monde, the bon ton, this fashionable society were ultra modern in their day. They were absolutely the cutting edge of fashion. They were the trendsetters. They had the money to spend. They were extravagant. They lived life in the fast lane. And, you know, we don't really see that on screen. And we have this idea of it as also sort of chaste and, you know, oh, just genteel is a word we often use for the period, but they were super fashionable at the time and vibrant, and their clothes were reported in the newspapers, you know, Bridgerton captures that with this technicolor, glorious, you know, often sort of joyous, in your face kind of embrace of fashionable, the idea of being in fashion or out of fashion. And I absolutely loved that, I have to say, as someone who's kind of studied this world of the bon ton, to see it being made modern, you know, was in keeping with what it felt like at the time to be in this world, you know.
Yes, and I loved so many of the scenes at Queen Charlotte's court. I wondered if we could talk a little bit about her. Who was she?
Well, Queen Charlotte's the queen. Yeah. So she's the wife of George III, who, you know, other people might know as the kind of the king that went mad, in inverted commas. And she's the mother of Prince Regent, the Prince of Wales. And she is, you know, the court is the pinnacle of society, you know, then. And she kind of, you know, did determine who was in and who was out of fashion to some extent. She didn't like disreputable women at her court. You know, the court was a place of great importance at the time. And we see that in Bridgerton. And, I was thinking before I worked on Bridgerton, have we ever seen that kind of court world, apart from in the kind of madness of King George, the play and the film? Do we see that world so much? I don't think we do. And I love that it's just, you know, mostly Charlotte and her ladies-in-waiting and all the dogs and absolutely wonderful court dresses, you know, just beautiful, like, kind of constructions of what was worn at court at the time. So, I mean, I just loved it all, didn't I, really? I should be more academic about it, but it was just great.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And so we're sort of playing with the idea of what would society look like under certain different circumstances, both drawing on what we know to be historical reality, but also by asking us to think more carefully about our expectations of what a period drama should look like.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal. So why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples. free shipping and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
You mentioned before, it's a bit different from Austin, from the other period dramas that perhaps come before it. And one way in which it's different is its diverse cast, race-blind casting. And you've written how society at the time is much more diverse than most of us probably assume. And though it pushes the envelope a bit, perhaps, in terms of what race relations looked like then, it does get us a bit closer to what society might have looked like. What can you say about that aspect of it?
Well, I think it encourages us to think about it more carefully, doesn't it? And I think, you know, within Bridgerton, it's been discussed by Chris Van Dusen, the showrunner, as not colour-blind casting, but colour-conscious casting, where actually it's not that you're ignoring race, but you're thinking about it quite carefully. And in Bridgerton, that happens in two ways. So one is that we introduce characters who are inspired by real historical characters. So we have a black boxer who's Will Mondrick in Bridgerton, who is inspired by Bill Richmond from the time. And then characters cast in places where we might not expect to see, you know, people of colour, so within the aristocracy. And so we're sort of playing with the idea of what would society look like under certain different circumstances, both drawing on what we know to be historical reality, but also by asking us to think more carefully about our expectations of what a period drama should look like, and also what it might be like if history was slightly different. So one of the aspects of Bridgerton is that it plays quite strongly on the idea that has been suggested at various points in history that Queen Charlotte has some kind of mixed race heritage. And you know, Bridgerton picks up on that and runs with it a bit further than we might otherwise do, and then ask the question, well, if she did have mixed race heritage, what would the society around her look like? What opportunities might there have been for other people to be elevated? And, you know, so it kind of, it makes us think about those ways. So it's a combination of a historical truth, which is that the past is more diverse than we tend to see on screen and we tend to accept in our popular imagination, but also then a fictionalizing of asking what might also history look like if under certain different circumstances. So it's doing both of those things, and I think that's really valuable, and drama can be really powerful in setting that up.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask about, there's some really striking scenes filmed at the Pleasure Gardens in Vauxhall are the setting for some of the scenes. And I wanted to chat maybe about the entertainments and opportunities these presented, and a bit about the staging of how those were kind of staged.
Yeah, well, again, this is just where I go, oh, that was amazing. Because, you know, a historian who has studied and written about Pleasure Gardens, I was on set when they were filming the Vauxhall scenes. It was a night shoot. We had huge cast, fireworks, lighting, music. And it's the closest I've ever been to being kind of genuinely transported to a different time and place. And, you know, the Pleasure Gardens are so difficult to describe, because to us now they seem sort of, I don't know, they lose their magic. It's just it's an outdoor pleasure ground where you pay for a ticket and it's full of entertainment, sort of what we're seeing as modern entertainment. So ideas of different kinds of music, of different kinds of sculpture, of different sorts of encounters with the natural world. As sun was setting, you know, in the early summer nights, it's a place where people came together. So anyone who could buy a ticket could enter. But part of the attraction was to see this fashionable world who might show up at some point. The gardens were lit up brightly at night, which is, you know, dramatic and magical in the early 19th century when there's not a huge amount of street lighting in everybody's life. And then it's also plays with a sense of adventure. The Pleasure Garden was a place where there was an element of risk, an advertised risk. So one of the great attractions was that, you know, you might stumble across someone you shouldn't in the dark walks. There might be drunken people there, that it took you to the edge of what was kind of morally acceptable. It's a sort of supercharged fairground / haunted house / something. But it doesn't really have a modern equivalent, but it's incredibly important in the 18th century as this new kind of entertainment. So, you know, I got to be in Vauxhall in filming. And so that was a delight. But it plays a role, doesn't it, in terms of the narrative that maybe we won't say because we don't want to give spoilers. But yes. there's an element of risk and drama that the pleasure garden always carries, which is part of Bridgerton's world.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, love it. So this is, it's a fun series, it's bright, it's a real kind of microcosm. How would the people below have regarded this social strata? Would it have been regarded as particularly opulent, as celebrity? What would that have been like?
Oh, yeah, they were the celebrities of the time. And it's sort of, I mean, what always attracted me as a historian to that world is not just the kind of the world of the glamour and the celebrity, but the ways in which in that very small elite was a massive concentration of power. So they were not just the kind of fashion celebrities of the day. They had all of the wealth, you know, staggering amounts of money, just huge amounts of money. They had these big London townhouses. So they all came to London for 6 months of the year. And the reason they came was Parliament. They were all the politicians. They occupied the Houses of Commons and the House of Lords. You know, they dominated the political infrastructure. They were the people who went to court. And it's a very small world. It's, you know, a few hundred families. And, you know, compared to the rest of society. So they were the ultra, ultra, ultra super rich with all the power. I mean, they were subject to a lot of kind of what you might say is public commentary, kind of, you know, public talk about their behaviour. You know, caricaturists ripped them apart. There was, you know, attempts to kind of moderate their behaviour. And what you see in very, very general historical terms, I mean, historians are going to write to me and complain when I say this, but, you know, we see a very general shift from a kind of, you know, fast living 18th century world to then a more kind of professional political life in the Victorian era, where people begin to distance themselves from their Georgian forebears and their kind of decadent ways. And the Regency is the kind of last hurrah of this decadence, this kind of, you know, moment with the Prince Regent, where this kind of fast living was part and parcel of the world. And you're seeing increasing kind of critical commentary about that behaviour and increasing concern about it in the run-up to the Great Reform Act of 1832, which increases the kind of social spread in Parliament and the access of people to the vote. And so this is the kind of the last moment of that Georgian decadence that we associate with the 18th century and early 19th century. So I think they were increasingly criticised. They were subject to increasing kind of pressures of moral reform. And there is a world of commentary that's sort of starting to hold people to account. But yeah, they are living in the fast lane still.
Right. And I mean, this, what Bridgerton does so well is really portray that kind of grandeur, that opulence, that sense of fun that must have been so kind of intoxicating at the time for a select few.
Yeah, a very select few. And it's just, you know, it's just that, I mean, it's just, you know, we don't really, I suppose we do have modern equivalents. I'm just so far removed from people who own their own island. but it's that, it is that sense of the huge social distance between those few people in that world of this, you know, kind of fashionable high society and how everyone else lived, which makes them both the subject of something that was like a celebrity world to consume, but also a fairly grotesque expression of inequality, for sure.
Right. And I mean, it doesn't address that, nor should it. It's, you know, it's a standalone thing, Regency romance through and through. And as a historian working on this, kind of, can you pick out a favourite moment or a moment where you really thought this is just brilliant?
Oh, well, I mean, we have talked about Vauxhall Gardens, and I loved that. And, you know, they filmed that overnight, so everyone was up all night. And I have small children, so that wasn't such a bother to me. But I could have stayed up, you know, for many nights to go to Vauxhall. And it just felt really exciting and special, I think, that particular moment. But there were so many. I mean, oh, God, just balls and the court and everything. I was just, you know, I don't feel like I really did any work. I was just sitting there going, oh, this is amazing, the whole time, which probably isn't hugely helpful, is it? but yeah, and I think, yeah, for me as a historian, Vauxhall has to be it, because it's so hard to capture that magic just by reading about it. You have to sort of be in it to really experience it. So that was the kind of the most experience. And then from a historian's point of view, I think it's exciting to see a period drama doing new things. I always love it when we try and think about different ways of putting the past on screen. This is not a history about everybody. It's not really a history lesson as such, because, you know, we're adapting a modern Regency romance, but it's got lots of elements of a historical world in it that I love and I'm familiar with. And I think it's nice that, you know, it's always a place for Jane Austen, but we don't always need another Jane Austen. Sometimes it's fun to do something different.
That was Hannah Gregg. Bridgerton is available to stream on Netflix worldwide now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow to hear Emily Gerry discussing the murder of Thomas Becket.